Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're exploring how the economics of equality, when it comes to LGBT minorities at least, is the economics of prejudice. Our panel will be discussing what can be done to address this. They'll consider issues around labour flexibility and mobility, and we'll be explaining how these themes help to form a compelling economic argument for countering prejudice. We'll hear from leaders within UBS, and indeed from the wider business and LGBT community, about the moral case for inclusivity too, and asking our contributors to share not only their expertise, but their insights and personal experiences in order to help focus on the ways that the continuing challenge posed by this prejudice can be met most effectively. We start with Paul Donovan, Chief Economist at UBS Global Wealth Management and the author of the recent piece Pride and Prejudice and Economists, which explores the theme. Paul, maybe we can start. Give us some of the background to that piece.
Pride Month, of course, is about tackling prejudice against people who are not heterosexual. And this is, I think, a significant problem. It's a growing problem from an economic point of view, because any form of prejudice is damaging to a company or it's damaging to an economy. And as we go into a period of dramatic change in the global economy, the risk is that prejudice rises in society. But at the same time, the costs of prejudice always rise. And so as part of the Pride Month, I and UBS generally wanted to try and get across the message that actually it's really important that we tackle prejudice in all of its forms. But prejudice against people who are not heterosexual is a particularly important and a particularly damaging form of prejudice that we need to try and get to grips with.
Now, Paul, I guess there's a key challenge here beyond the one you've already outlined, and that's the fact that often, and one imagines, that economists like yourself want to start by saying, right, let's get all the data together and see what we can learn from that. And that in itself is a challenge, of course, because, understandably, of course, some of the data is rather limited precisely because of these prejudices and this pressure on some people not to be completely open about their sexuality. Can you tell us a bit about what that problem means and how to best overcome it?
So this is a very big issue for economics. Prejudice against people who are not heterosexual is unusual because, in a sense, people volunteer to be targets of prejudice. You can lie about who you are at work. You can pretend to be somebody different. Now, that's got a whole host of economic problems and psychological problems and other issues, but you can do that if you want, and then you can avoid being the target of personal prejudice. You'd still be the target of general prejudice. People would make remarks against LGBTQ people in the workplace, but it wouldn't be directed at you personally. And so as a result, the evidence varies from country to country because people are not always honest in terms of how they fill in surveys. But it appears to be that in many developed countries, around about half of the working population who are LGBTQ do not identify as being such at work. And that means, of course, that getting the data on this is very difficult. How do we overcome that? Well, there are some surveys, there are some indicators which ask people in complete confidence and where people hopefully trust the survey, and that can give us some evidence. We have evidence of people who have come out, who have faced up to the prejudice and who talk about what it was like before they came out and what it was like after they came out. And that can also be quite helpful in terms of gauging the impact of prejudice. And then, of course, we know and we can see and identify what prejudice does in a general sense. If we know that prejudice means that people make irrational decisions about hiring or irrational decisions about promotion, then we know what irrational decision-making does to a company's profits or to an economy's efficiency. And the short answer is it's not good. If you're going to be prejudiced, you're going to end up with bad economic outcomes.
Caroline Binashi is UBS Global Head of Diversity and Inclusion. Carol-Anne, before we go into more detail of Paul's piece and other research in this area, can you talk to us a little about the variation, I suppose, in the global picture? There are such stark contrasts. Look, you know, you and I are sat in London as Pride March this very weekend, Pride Month ongoing, and that's all well and good, but that's precisely because it is happening in an environment in which that is supported, encouraged, celebrated. Is there ever a risk that that obscures the scale of the global problem here around prejudice against LGBT people, precisely because, you know, in certain markets we're just more, I don't know, advanced in the narrative?
Well, I think that's exactly the point when you are in a global company, and in my role as global head of diversity, I'm charged with leading a global strategy around a pile of elements of inclusion when the world operates in very different jurisdictions. Let me just throw out some stats which I think are helpful. So we know that 93% of Fortune 500 companies have some kind of internal policy that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation for their employees. And those are normally global values-based principles that run through all of those companies. However, we also know that currently there are 75 countries in the world that have laws that criminalize same-sex conduct. And actually 8 of those countries have laws where same-sex conduct is actually punishable by death. So you can be executed in 8 countries in the world today for being LGBT. And so there's this disconnect, isn't there, between what you want to do as a company, which is about helping everybody feel valued, everyone feel included, exactly because of all the things that Paul talks about in his research. But on the ground, in some of those communities where you're operating, the infrastructure makes that very difficult. So I think that is a complexity that we have to navigate. And I think the question is, how do you navigate that while staying core and aligned to your principles around inclusion and respect and valuing everybody regardless of difference, but also staying on the right side of the local law? And that's something that I've spent quite a lot of time thinking about.
Lord Brown of Maddingley is former chief executive of energy giant BP, currently executive chairman of L1 Energy. In 2014, he published The Glass Closet, which discussed the rewards of coming out in business and advocating for inclusive corporate policy led from the top of institutions down through the chain. Lord Brown, it's important, isn't it, I suppose, to remember or to underscore the fact that this powerful economic case that we've been hearing about supports the obvious moral imperative here.
Inclusion has great financial rewards, as well as being the right thing to do. Obviously, inclusion speaks right into a person's human rights, to be equal, to be accepted for what they are, not what other people want them to be. But when it comes to business, it's even more important. Obviously, to have the right approach to LGBTQ ideals is to be able to recruit the very best people. But more importantly even is when they arrive in a company, when people can be themselves and be part of a team and be demonstrated that they are part of a team, people act in a very different way. And study after study shows that inclusion really done appropriately produces increased profits. And it clearly does. Every study shows that over 20 years, every company that has highly engaged and inclusive teams produces 2% more return every year. That's really worth having.
Paul Donovan, given the benefits and given the costs, I think there's a World Bank estimate cited in your piece that prejudice cost India, for example, more than $30 billion in lost output. Why do we not see more progress and more progressive thinking, for that matter, whether that's from countries or corporations?
Well, it is. I mean, there's a whole mix of issues that come through around prejudice. Sometimes it's a religious background or cultural background. Sometimes it's just lack of understanding. Now, the Kinsey study famously estimated that about 10% of the population are LGBTQ. And one of the interesting things is that surveys from Gallup in the past have suggested that the number was a lot lower. It was about 3-4% of the population. But the Gallup surveys have shown more and more people saying that they're LGBTQ as time has gone on, and particularly with the younger generation, who I think feel less pressured about this, more and more of them are admitting this. But at the end of the day, if 10% of the population is not heterosexual, they are a minority. And so one of the problems is that when we get times of change and uncertainty and so on, a lot of people in a period of economic change will look for scapegoats, look for somebody to target. People almost feel better about themselves if they can push someone else down. And a minority group, like people who are not heterosexual, who don't identify as being heterosexual, may then become obvious targets of prejudice in a time of change. And that, I think, is one of the real challenges that we're facing up to, that hate crime does increase in periods of economic turmoil and uncertainty about the future.
And if I can put that point to you too, Lord Brown, why is progress not fast enough, given it's demonstrably the case that doing the right thing here pays?
I believe the glass is very much half full. It's not half empty, but a long way to go. It is a complex problem. It's about setting the right environment in a corporation where people can actually feel safe, really feel safe about being themselves. And not just feeling, but seeing that other people are safe and that they succeed by being themselves. Mm-hmm. So they look right to the top to see whether the man or woman who is at the top of the firm is being themselves, being authentic, and really believing that inclusion is an important part of leadership. I think, for me, leadership is defined only with two dimensions. One is to be able to be totally convinced about your purpose and to communicate that, and to be totally convinced about being the need to be inclusive and communicating that the whole time and demonstrating it by having role models that succeed by being part of that inclusive team.
Lord Brown. Let's hear next from Simon Smiles, UBS CIO for Ultra High Net Worth. Simon, perhaps you can pick up on some of the themes we've been hearing about already and tell us a bit about the investor takeaway and strategic positioning here as well. What are some of the mechanics?
Well, it's actually two broad areas. It's relevant with respect to corporate performance and profitability. It's also very relevant with respect to individuals' financial positions. So with respect to the first factor, why is it relevant with respect to corporate performance and profitability? Very simple. Discrimination against LGBT individuals means not selecting employees purely on their merit and competence. And this is allowed in an astounding 63% of United Nations countries. Now, diversity with respect to both employees and also management has been regularly proven to increase financial performance. Now, this includes sexuality and lifestyle preferences, gender, age, race, background, and experience. By definition, the more diversity you have in a business, the more focus you have on individuals' competence and ability to drive performance, the better your company's performance is. Conversely, if you're discriminating against people based on their sexuality, it leads to underperformance.
Lord Brown, perhaps we can come back to you before the end of the programme. If we look at the bigger picture on prejudice against LGBT people, especially in the corporate space, where are we at? I guess there's a perception to some degree of greater intolerance, you know, here post-Brexit in the UK, for example. But are we heading broadly in the right direction?
Well, I think we as the UK generally are. But the world is replete with bigotry. And it always will be. It's a matter of having constant vigilance to make sure it doesn't overwhelm. But, you know, it is true that when the going gets tough, the majority always hurt the minority. And the minority is expressed in many different ways, depending on the time and place and the nation. So constant vigilance is needed to make sure that we don't suddenly say the problem is solved. The problem, if it is a problem, is never solved. It's always one of dynamic tension to make sure that people can be themselves as they are, not as people want them to be. I'm optimistic because I compare what I think the future is going to be compared with the past, which was pretty dark. And there's been a lot of progress. We just have to keep it going. To me, in the corporate sector, I'm very encouraged by corporations that have very large ally programs. I think being in a gay ghetto is a bad idea. This is part of life, it's part of great society, and we need everybody to be acutely aware that we have to include people regardless of their background, their sexuality, their gender, their race, and to have allies actively working to make sure that happens. It's terrific.
And Simon Smiles, a final thought, takeaway, if you like, from you here on the challenge, the nature of it, the scale of the challenge that remains.
I find the fact that the number of countries which are still legally allowed to discriminate against individuals based purely on their sexuality or the way they identify themselves is something which, from an ideological and cultural perspective, I firmly believe makes no sense. It's again, though, when one looks at this with respect to the economic impacts, when one looks at this with respect to the financial impacts, when one looks at this with respect to the corporate performance impacts, rationally and purely financially, it also doesn't make sense.
And that's Simon Smiles, bringing us to the end of this 196th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at the website or catch up via your preferred podcast platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.